is Webster Griffin Tarpley, and he's written a book called 9/11, Synthetic Terror. And this word synthetic is of great interest to me, and that is what is real, what is fabricated, and what is something that we should be truly concerned about. So, Webster, thank you so much for joining me on this show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. Now, what do you feel is blocking the American public from their full birthright as inheritors of this Constitution, which it seems as though the world over is recognized as a huge accomplishment?
Well, the Constitution, I think, is a document that's it's far from being exhausted, and it still has a considerable amount to give. But the problem is that we have had September 11th, 2001, and I guess we can take our current problems more or less directly back to that. The goal of September 11th has been to create a kind of prison house of the human mind. It's to create a reign of terror and to imprison people within this and to set up a series of conditioned reflexes around words like Atta and Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and so forth, and to convince people essentially that a fantastic myth is actually the organizing principle of the world. If you look at the world today, you'll see that international relations are dominated by something called a war on terror, which, if you look at it more closely, is completely non-existent. The United States government, the Republican Party...
Excuse me, non-existent? I want to just stop for people who feel there really is terror out there and terrorists.
Well, there's terror, but the thesis of my book is that this is largely organized. And when you get to the spectacular, large-scale acts of international terrorism, it's almost completely organized by nation states, and among these, the United States and Great Britain take the first rank. And that includes Arab or Islamic fundamentalism, which they have organized for years, Chechen terrorism, which I talk about to some extent, organized from London and New York, Posada Carriles, a servant of the Bush family, very closely linked to people like George Bush the Elder and Jeb Bush, was of course a Cuban terrorist, an anti-Castro Cuban terrorist who blew up an airplane with 75 people on board. So there's a lot of talk about terrorism, but when we actually go and look and actually delve into concrete cases, as I try to do in this book, 9/11 being, of course, the most spectacular example of all time, what you'll see is the hand of a network, which I call the rogue network, the deep state, if you like, the invisible government, the parallel government, the secret team, things of this sort. It's a network inside the Pentagon, the CIA, the DIA, the NSA, and so forth. And they have, as Senator Inouye said back during the Iran-Contra period, when this invisible government was very much in the public eye, Senator Inouye pointed out that there is this other entity, not the elected government, although there's a certain overlap between the secret and the elected, but a secret government that has its own Pentagon, its own foreign policy, its own notions of national interest. It has its own treasury. This is, in my view, what is behind 9/11.
Now, Webster, that's very shocking for a lot of people who have been raised with the classic education, the classic entertainment or news that's coming on.
I don't know what you mean by classic. I think I actually represent the classic point of view. In other words, if you know your Roman history, you know, the conspiracy of Catiline, or if you know Machiavelli, those are classics. And with that equipment, you can understand this right away.
Okay. So
nothing has changed under the sun.
So let's just briefly go into your education, your background.
Just that I try to represent this point of view. I'm a follower of Plato. I guess you'd say I'm a Platonic absolute idealist.
Mm-hmm.
I would bring in Machiavelli as a political theorist, and I would go with Leibniz pretty much on matters of epistemology and science.
Okay, now I'm sure for average people in the audience who may not have that much education, that won't mean a whole lot, but it sounds like you're saying this is not new, right?
No, nothing new. It's the perennial philosophy.
It goes back
to Plato.
So when Plato talks about the analogy in the cave, that we're looking at shadows and thinking they're reality, he's giving encouragement that we can turn around, or with the help of a good teacher, perhaps like you, you know, someone that can waken people up. And yet Aristotle came around and said, Plato wasn't that practical. Do you see yourself as a practical man?
I am a determined enemy of Aristotle. I think Aristotle was a fraud. I think Aristotle is the greatest factor of the corruption of human thinking that we've had, at least in the Western world, although there were equivalents in other traditions. And I would go very, very much with Plato against Aristotle. Aristotle being a kind of a countergang to Plato, a Delphic, hooked-up version of Plato, concocted by the enemies of Plato to have something that looked more or less like Plato, but where the internal essence was completely different. I don't think we can resolve this question now, but if we could just mention the cave, because this is what I talk about in my book. I have a chapter on the problem of collective schizophrenia in the modern United States, which I think is a very acute problem. The lack of a sense of reality and the lack of a sense of inner direction of the individual. It goes back to what David Riesman was able to observe back in the 1950s about the other directed or conformist individual, the individual who has a set of shifting opinions that are dictated by shifting peer groups, and contrasting that to the more autonomous, more independent, and more reason-oriented, inner-directed personality, sometimes associated with the stern moralists of the 19th century. But it's still possible to do this today. What Plato wrote about was a cave in which the wall in front of the people was illuminated by a kind of a diffuse daylight. The people were tied into place. They could only look at the wall in front of them. And in addition to that diffuse daylight, there was a fire behind them, and various effigies were paraded behind them, casting shadows on the wall, so that the people could look at that and think that that was reality, think that what was projected on the wall was actual reality. And they began to compare one shadow to another and talk about the order in which the shadows appeared. And as Plato points out, this is precisely the human condition which philosophy seeks to free you from. So I even have a picture in there, maybe you want to show it when you put this broadcast together, but in Plato's day, it was the shadows on the wall.
This one?
Today, yeah, that would be the original one.
Can you zoom into this?
But then if we go a few pages further, if we go a few pages beyond that.
Okay. Let's go a few pages beyond.
And then you'll see the modern version, which is the same wall. Instead of the shadows of those days, it's now the exploding building. And of course, the question is sense certainty. That is, you think you see something, but then the question is, what is it that you really see? That has been explained. The fall of the Twin Towers in New York City on September 11th has been explained by a number of official reports coming from the Congress, the House, the Senate, the Kane-Hamilton Commission, the National Bureau of Standards.
Explain to our audience now the fall of the towers.
Well, what everybody sees. The powers come crashing down. And the question with that is, what is happening here? And the official explanation is, the fall of the towers is caused by the impact of airplanes and by the subsequent fire. And the problem with that, of course, is that no modern fireproof skyscraper in the history of the world has ever fallen down, ever collapsed, before 9/11 or after 9/11, only on 9/11. And on that day, you have two very large skyscrapers, the Twin Towers, right, North and South Tower, crashing down as a result of the impact of an airplane and the result of a fire. Fire very limited in nature, and the impact limited to one aircraft, we think. It looks like an aircraft. It maybe there's really some question about whether, even in this case, there were aircraft, at least of the kind that the government says. So these come crashing down. If you look at the progress of research in this matter, you'll see that now that the reports of the firemen have been published back during the summer of 2005, right, the tapes that had been kept secret and withheld from the public for so many years, that indicates very strongly that the fire in particular in the South Tower was about to go out at the time that the building collapsed. And that it was a pattern, as I wrote about in my book, a pattern of secondary explosions in all parts of these buildings that preceded the fall. Mm. So the weight of informed opinion about the two towers is that they represent an example of controlled demolition. That it's essentially dog and pony show, that you're being presented with what amounts to an illusion, that the plane hits the building falls down, you're supposed to think, well, the plane is the cause of the building falling down, and there is no physical way in the universe that we know that this could have happened. It's simply impossible. And then we get to the reductio ad absurdum of the entire thing, which is building seven, right? The third building that fell down, not in the morning, not at noon, not at 3 o'clock, but at 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the afternoon. Yet another building, a 45-story skyscraper that would have been the largest building in many cities in the world, came down. It had not been hit by any airplane. It showed only very small fires inside the building structure. And we have this very interesting quotation from the owner of these buildings, a guy called Silverstein, saying, "We decided to pull the building." Pull, apparently, jargon in the controlled demolition world for activate controlled demolition.
No, I heard his voice. It was about 5 o'clock. He's talking, and they recorded it. You know, they said the firemen had a long day, and they want to go home.
It's interview after the fact, but he's referring to events at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which indicates if the building was going to come down, how could he know that in advance if it was simply natural processes? How could you know this? And again, you can look at similar buildings in Los Angeles, in Philadelphia, in Caracas, in Madrid, on and on. Buildings 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 stories tall. It's very severe fires. I saw last summer one in Madrid, the Wellington building, I think it's called. The Windsor building, sorry, which had burned. It was 40 stories tall. It had burned lustily for 24 hours and did not collapse. Whereas these buildings allegedly collapsed, even though they had been built in a very, very robust manner with upwards of 40 very strong central core columns. So this is simply impossible. It's fantastic.
Okay. So,
and you've got this pattern of secondary explosions. I think what we're dealing with, if I can just round out the point, in the case of the two towers, you're dealing with controlled demolition of an extremely robust type. In other words, a very, very forceful... High-tech, perhaps even verging on what we'd have to call new physical principles. In other words, there's some question about the amount of explosive that would be needed to generate this phenomenon that you see, because the building is literally vaporized in midair.
Even perhaps
pulverized.
Nuclear?
I don't see how it could be nuclear, because then this would be immediately noticeable with Geiger counters and other equipment that anybody could bring into the area. And I think that has been looked into. It doesn't seem to me to be feasible to use nuclear, but
I heard that studies were repressed.
Yeah, I'm sure they have been. But the problem is, if that had been a nuclear bomb, you would be able to take a Geiger counter right down there today still and notice an extremely high background radiation, which I don't think has been done.
Something, because I notice on your book you don't have the towers. You have
right, but just.
Different.
We can go on to this. The building 7, I would say, is a classic controlled demolition. It looks like controlled demolitions always look like. So it doesn't seem to be of this robust variety. In other words, the towers explode. Building 7 implodes. The towers are vaporized and pulverized in midair, and they throw debris 75, 100, 150 meters out in every direction. They cut... Somehow these central core columns, which are the main structure of the building, are neatly cut like spaghetti into 30-meter lengths. Mm-hmm. This is impossible. So all of that argues for a very, very sophisticated and
powered. How do you know that?
You can simply see it. You can see all of the pictures that have been taken of this. If the official theory is called the pancake theory, and it says, well, one floor began to crash down and then hit more and more floors, and they all pancaked on top of each other, and it became a kind of
a record on a spindle.
A snow slide, a mud slide of things coming down. The problem with that is that doesn't explain any force in the world that would have neatly chopped the central core columns, upwards of 45 or so of them, into such neat lengths.
47, actually.
47, whatever they are.
But I heard they cleaned up the area. So where are these pieces?
Well, they've all been destroyed. They've all been sent to China and made into paperclips or automobiles.
So how do you know they were 37 meters or 30
Because
meters?
You could see that the entire building collapsed neatly into its own base, its own footprint. And the problem was, if you had those core columns reaching upwards of 110 stories, they would either have been still standing mm-hmm. as the internal skeleton of the building or fallen over right. at a certain point. But again, there is no force in any part of this story. There's no physical force that would be able to chop those core columns into the pieces that would be needed.
What we can do in post-production is put a little picture up that shows the most explosive moment, and then you see the little beams. Because in the picture...
There are huge amounts of rubble being thrown out.
So is that what was measured and estimated to be 30 meters? Or?
It's simply that when you come to the bottom of this, right, in the mm-hmm. days after, they load the wreckage onto trucks.
Oh, I see.
And it's more or less chopped into the proper lengths.
I see.
Something has intervened to cut the core columns in this way, which is beyond the reach of anything that is mentioned in the official story. An airplane can't do it, and a low-temperature jet fuel fire starved of oxygen. And again, in the South Tower, every indication is the fire is about to go out. The irony of the whole thing is the North Tower gets hit first but falls second. The South Tower is hit second but falls first. And the irony of that seems to be that the controllers of this thing, observing it from wherever they were, and it's not clear to me where they were, but they were somewhere, noticed that the fire was about to go out, and therefore they had to pull that one. They had to activate their controlled demolition, because if the fire had gone out completely, they would have been left with this absurd anomaly of a building which was no longer burning, collapsing half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour after the plane had impacted. And this, I think, even the densest person, right, probably even George Bush would begin to wonder what was happening at that point. So we have all that.
Now, okay, so
we wanted to go to...
Well, no, let me just one thing. So we've demonstrated the sophistication of bringing these buildings down.
Right.
It was a sophisticated operation, whoever did it. Now, the next step is, if it was a controlled demolition and not anything like what the official report is saying, isn't that terribly shocking?
Yes, it is. I mean, I've learned to live with this for quite a while now.
Now, the first time you what was it the first time the shock came to you? To help viewers who are now going through shock the first time.
I was sitting in a conference in Berlin, and I heard all about it. The guy came into the conference in Berlin and said what had happened, and he said the two towers have collapsed, the Pentagon is burning, airplanes have crashed into these places. And my reaction was, oh, my God, it's them. It's them, meaning the Iran-Contra secret government.
That's what you think.
Yeah, you need historical continuity in this stuff.
And you're a historian.
Yeah. The background that's relevant, let me just go into this for a second. I spent the 1970s and the 1980s as a journalist in Central Europe. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things was, if you were in Germany and Italy in those years, there were two things you had to know about. The Red Brigade's terrorists and the Bader-Meinhof Group terrorists, because they were very prominent in public affairs. And in particular,
they're dangerous
terrorists.
And bad.
Yeah, these are bad, but they're run by NATO intelligence, and that was clear to me at the time.
You knew that?
Yes, that was run by the
Did
CIA.
Did you know that from your Princeton education or from later on?
No, please, no.
Nothing you learned
No,
in
everything
class.
From Princeton went in the opposite
direction.
So
this
direction.
Is in the 70s? That yeah. You're in Central Europe?
Central Europe in the 70s and 80s, and I'm watching terrorism
now,
being
just
used.
Let me slow down again. Are you more vivacious than most journalists, or most journalists trying to search down a good story?
It's just,
and
I think
research
it's a variety.
Would find out what you found out.
It helps the United States. It helps to have a lot of foreign experience, because then you're less filled with this implicitly chauvinistic, narrow-minded
now,
U.S.
Okay,
mindset.
Okay, I can understand, because I'm not even a journalist. I've lived abroad, and I have a different perspective just from that living abroad. But what I'm trying to understand is, are you different from most journalists, or would any journalist doing a good job, being where you were at that time and trying to figure out this terrorist organization, have come to the same conclusions?
I can't speculate about what other people might have done. All I can do is tell you what I've done, and you have to go and ask them. I don't notice a lot of them doing it, even at that time. The number is very limited.
I used to live on the island of Cyprus for 4 years, and once when I was in a health food store, because that's kind of my lifestyle, I met a journalist who was very frustrated that their story about the Gulf War wasn't getting published. So I'm thinking that maybe good journalists might not get published.
Well, that can happen too.
Okay.
So and if you have a foundation grant, you can forget about that too. But what I noticed was that the Bader-Meinhof group, and in particular the Italian Red Brigades, were run by the CIA and by MI6, NATO, British intelligence. So mm-hmm. NATO intelligence, if we want to refer to the two of them. And in 1978, I was approached by a member of the Italian government who asked me to write a short study, it got to be a long study, of the media response to the kidnapping and murder of the former Prime Minister Aldo Moro, who had been killed by the Red Brigades, and his body left in central Rome about two blocks from where I worked. So I spent the summer of 1978 with a group of friends putting out a dossier, Who Killed Aldo Moro, published in Italian, Chi ha ucciso Aldo Moro, Rome, 1978. Never made into English, interestingly enough, because we had to do it in Italian for the Italian government.
Do you speak Italian?
Government, yes.
Yeah.
And the finding there was Henry Kissinger had been involved, Richard Gardner, the U.S. ambassador, and others. And after this book came out, Moro's widow revealed that her husband had been threatened by Kissinger, basically saying, if you don't stop trying to bring the Communist Party into the government, something terrible will happen to you. Mm-hmm. So,
74 again?
78.
78.
78, 79.
Long after Cyprus was invaded, huh?
Yes.
Yes.
A good 10 years. But if there's
they're not
stuff,
happy with him
by the way, the Greek, if you want to read something about Greek terrorism, there's stuff in here about that.
Yeah.
There's this Greek group, the 22nd of November, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the November group. And the anniversary, I think, is the coup.
Right.
The coup of the colonels. That group was run out of the Greek Interior Ministry. Now, when you find terrorists in the Interior Ministry, the naive person says, oh, my God, the terrorists have penetrated the Interior Ministry, the police ministry. But the sophisticated observer says, no, the terrorists are actually being run by the police, by the intelligence agencies, which is the case here. So when I saw 9/11, I said...
You're in Berlin. You just got the news.
September 11th, 2001.
You knew about the terrorist
groups.
It's
them.
You're logical.
And them means Iran, Contra, secret government, invisible government networks. In other words, the kind of thing that you associated with Poindexter, with Oliver North, with Felix Rodriguez, and this group... This group of gun runners and drug runners in Central America who had tentacles into the East Bloc, into East Germany and Poland with Schalk Golotkowski and all kinds of other things that we can't go into now. But the fact is, you look at an event like this and you say, who has the ability to bring that about? One question is, how do you paralyze U.S. air defense for almost 2 hours? 1 hour and 45 minutes, depends on how you want to count it, 150.
So you thought these conscripts couldn't do it? Your group couldn't do it?
Of course they could do it. The invisible government is the group who can do it. In other words, them.
So
them means, in this case, that the only force that can paralyze U.S. air defense for at least 1 hour and 45 minutes is the U.S. command itself. It is NORAD. It is the Pentagon. It is the Air Force.
What's NORAD?
North American Air Defense Command, which was the agency that should have shot down these planes if it came to that. And they didn't do it. They didn't show up at all, except
And just because
perhaps,
I don't know, I'm just saying I'm really new at all of this. NORAD is with NATO?
How
does it tie in with your
NATO
experience
is,
that you were saying in Europe?
Yeah, because this is all of a piece of the same cloth. NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Okay.
It's essentially the U.S. plus Canada plus Western Europe.
And their terrorist organization killed your guy in Israel.
NATO is a military alliance,
which
pretends to be defensive and a wonderful group of people. But in reality, they have an intelligence force which carried out what I described as spheres of influence or geopolitical terrorism. And the purpose of this was to maintain the integrity, the solidity of the Western alliance vis-a-vis the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact. And Italy was an obvious place for this because it had a very large communist party that might have made the country go neutral. And these NATO people didn't want Italy to go neutral.
Right.
They wanted it to stay squarely under the thumb of the U.S. and the British. Germany, a similar story, tendencies towards neutralism.
Right.
The other thing that they didn't like was they didn't like the idea that people in Germany and Italy were interested in serious capital investment in Africa and actual economic development of the Third World. Anglo-Americans don't like that. So they turned against it. Now, we got to leave this behind, because otherwise it gets to be too long. NORAD is a U.S. Canada creation. They're out there in Colorado Springs, Colorado, right? North American Air Defense Command and Space Command now. And they're supposed to be the defense of the North American continent.
Okay.
But they didn't defend the North American continent, did they?
Okay.
Now, in the Cold War, it was a cliche.
So there you are.
Everybody knew that you had to have your planes in the air within 5 minutes. Why 5 minutes? Because there was going to be a Soviet submarine about 50 miles from here where we're sitting, right, off the coast of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet submarine was going to launch a missile against Washington, D.C. So you had to get everything in the air within 5 or 10 minutes, depending on where you were. So 5 minutes, 10 minutes was the
because
Cold War
after
standard.
That,
after that, they'd be blown up in a serious war. And
really?
That's what you had
so
to
they,
be ready
so
for.
So a serious military man would plan for that.
Yes, and, they, and then
so
that really
he wants to give his orders before he's gone.
Yes, and you also you have to get the president and the vice president into the air, right? Because you can't leave them in that primitive old bunker under the White House. So none of that was done. 1 hour and 45 minutes and no air defense, except if it is true that the people in the Shanksville airplane, right, the Let's Roll airplane, if those passengers really did take over the airplane, there would have been a compelling reason for the U.S. government to shoot down that airplane. Why? If the passengers had been able to land that plane, let's just go with the official story a little bit, when that plane landed, we would have found either hijackers who could have been interrogated or no hijackers, which would have been a revelation in itself. And the airplane could have been examined for signs of remote control. Global Hawk. In other words, there's one body of opinion which I still embrace in my book, which I've become a little bit more doubtful about, which is that the way in which this was done was that the airplanes were seized ultimately not by these primitive hijackers who don't have the ability to fly airplanes, but they were simply taken over from the ground by remote control apparatus known as Global Hawk and crashed into the buildings that way.
Do you have the pictures of those people that were supposed to have done it?
No, and you don't need them because they're irrelevant.
I know, but you seemed, in the speech that you gave that I saw a video of, you seemed to know for sure they couldn't fly airplanes.
Yes, absolutely, they couldn't fly
airplanes. And that can be, that's evidence that other people can
get
hold of?
There's a tremendous body of evidence that what happened was that these characters, and again, they are double agents, some of them, like Atta, working for the Pentagon, and they know it.
Okay.
And others who are dupes, fanatics, psychotics, misfits, who don't know what they're doing.
Right.
Maybe they think they're in a terrorist cell.
But they're useful for an overall
They're
picture.
Useful idiots because they're being manipulated, but you're moving too fast to finish the
Actually,
points.
Actually, I want
to... Okay? The point is that if you look at those people, they were sent to airplane flight schools to learn how to fly, but not really to learn how to fly, to be sheep-dipped. As we say, in other words, they have to make a pretense of learning how to fly. They have to go and take a few flight lessons in order to make it credible for the gullible masses that they could have flown the planes. But if you read the reports then of the teachers, the people who actually taught them, they say, these people can't fly, they're hopeless, they're basket cases, they're misfits, they can't do it.
Now, I want to back up a little bit back to you in Berlin to try to see if I can create a connection of empathy between the audience that's watching and hearing this for the first time and what it was like for you, although you were far more knowledgeable, when you heard it for the first time. So when you're in Berlin, can you tell me the sequence of the information that you got and your reaction?
A guy came into this room at the university and said, airplanes have struck the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the Twin Towers have collapsed and the Pentagon is in flames.
So before any more information, you
knew... It's them.
Okay, before any more information, you knew that, even though you didn't have the details, that for this to have happened, an hour and a half had to have elapsed of unsupervised time in the air, for example?
Or? Not the details. The question is, what force, if you've lived in the world for a while, you get to know what there is in the world. In other words, the world is not a mystery.
And you knew the world of protecting buildings and assets.
At the level of this, you're talking about the U.S., the British, the Soviets, the Chinese, and the French, more or less. And then there are some others that can come into play. And you look at this and say, well, who could do that? Oh, the Israelis, too. Don't forget them. But you look at them, you look at an event like this, and you say, Who could do that? Could the Soviets do that? Russians? No. The British? Well, maybe. The French? Probably not. The Mossad? I don't think so, because it has to involve the U.S. And then the other question is...
Why do you say the Russians couldn't do it?
Because the Russians do not control the air defense of North America. They cannot.
I see.
Only the U.S. controls the U.S. air defense of North America, even though it's a joint Canadian. And the other question is, the resources involved in this are so large that only governments, only state agencies have sufficient assets, money, communications, personnel, access.
As demonstrated by the sophistication with which the buildings went down.
Or as demonstrated by the fact that none of these characters had been arrested.
Okay.
Right? So where they popped up on various lists. Right? There's even a story. There's a story that they had Atta's picture on the wall in early 2001 or even 2000.
Right.
And they had a post-it note on it saying, you can't arrest him. In other words, there's a national security override on Atta, which is exactly how they do all these things. So the details get filled in later. But you see, when you have an event of that magnitude...
I know, that's why I'm trying to give my new audience a wide perspective.
The main thing is you have a conceptual intuition saying something of this magnitude could only be done by a force within the U.S. command structure itself with, I would say, British assistance. And that comes a little bit later.
Now, let's use this term, conceptual intuition. Mm. Now, your conceptual intuition is also fortified by a lot of hardcore facts over the years.
Let me just interrupt. You can't go with conceptual intuition alone. In other words, all of that has got to be verified.
Right.
It's got to be checked. It's got to be documented. I couldn't rush into print with
of
a conceptual
course.
Intuition.
Exactly.
So the fact is this book came out in... late 2004, now, really, to early 2005, rather than 2001, because it took me a while to put together an adequate account of what I thought there was.
Exactly.
We also have to realize there's also a shock effect of these things, which nobody is immune to.
That's what I want
to... People are shocked.
Not even
absolutely.
You?
No.
Not even you?
No, of course not.
You get shocked?
Yes, of course.
So you were shocked in Berlin?
But at the same time, maybe the advantage I have is to say, oh my God, I'm shocked. What I did was I the evening of this, I went to the Berlin Cathedral, Berliner Dom, which is this 19th century building where a memorial service was held that very evening, and I went and watched that. I met a guy there that I knew, one of the people who actually works in this Berliner Dom. And then I happened to find myself the following day at this very interesting building. Do you know Berlin at all?
No, I don't.
Well, in what used to be West Berlin, there's a church called the Emperor William Memorial Church, Kaiser Wilhelm Gedächtniskirche, which was kept in rubble. It was kept in rubble. It's a church that's reduced to rubble, and it's got a modern part, but most of it's rubble. So you go there, what you're actually looking at is the rubble of World War II. You're looking at shrapnel, bullets.
Why did they keep it like that?
As a memorial to World War II.
Oh, exactly.
It's for the memorial. Exactly. It's a memorial to all the millions of people that died in World War II.
I
so I happened to go to stop in and see this place, and this Lutheran preacher came out, and they were having round-the-clock prayer services. And I went there just to witness this, right, to see what it looked like. And I realized that... first of all, that the goal of them, the people who had carried out 9/11, was obviously to turn world history as a whole in an absolutely destructive direction. And the direction that they wanted was the war of civilizations. Because by this time now, it's already the day after, they're beginning to put out this stuff, Al-Qaeda bin Laden. And we had...
A second, who would want such a thing?
Well, this is the doctrine of the people who are running the United States, who are running Britain.
Now,
they're known as the neocons.
This is what I want to slow down on, because this is very shocking. People we need to think that we are being represented and protected by our leaders.
Not if you read Plato and Machiavelli.
Let's go back to Plato. In Plato, there's that hope that once he's given us the lay of the land, that shadows have become our reality. Surely Plato is not denying us of the solution.
Well, the solution is the philosopher king, but or queen. Philosopher queen is also definitely a part of it.
In Plato?
Yeah, sure. But what Plato shows us usually goes on is oligarchy, tyranny, and what we have here naturally
plutarchy.
Is oligarchy. This is
it's
a plutocracy.
This
is a plutocracy here. The United States, the British and the United States are the oligarchical principle. It's interesting that Anglo-American political scientists never talk about this. They say, well, there's democracy and there's dictatorship.
Right.
Yeah, wait a minute, there's a third. And that's the one the British have had. The British got it from the Venetians, right? The Venetian Republic was an oligarchy that went on for the best part of 1,000 years. That was transferred to the British in the 1600s. And now we have it today. In other words, we have a society dominated not by priests, not by generals, not by bureaucrats, not by demagogues.
Not by politicians?
No, but by finance oligarchs, by financiers.
By financiers.
Financiers run the society, and they buy and sell the politicians, and that's what you see. Now, this is a collapsing
empire. Do you
know
in Hinduism they have a concept of great expanses of time, different yugas, they call them?
But different
castes, and a better yuga, you know, where there's harmony and justice, is more or less run by the educated or the priests.
Bad ones
are done by businessmen. So I'm just saying, if it's the financiers...
I guess you have to find wisdom wherever you can find it. But yeah, if you talk about this, I'm simply going to reveal my own ignorance because my
background is a different one.
On Plato, we have an oligarchy. And the goal of any oligarchy is to maintain itself as an oligarchy. Now, during the 1990s, globalization destroyed the world. The world was not destroyed by 9/11. The world had been thoroughly destroyed. The Russians had been destroyed. Most third world countries had been destroyed in terms of infrastructure and standard of living by this
phenomenon.
More
than the Black Plague in Europe and the Inquisition?
Well, these are so far away that they're really not comparable to our present time. But
to the destruction.
The world has been destroyed in the sense as a viable economic entity. The world has been destroyed during the 1990s. Now, at the end of all that, we're left with the dollar dominating the world and the ferocious, fanatical devotion of the U.S. and the British bankers to maintaining Anglo-American world domination, doing that through military means from day to day. But in general, it's done through the dollar. It's done through the economic hitman, if you know that analysis, which is just a little part of what you'd have to say.
What do you think of
dollar.
Him, by the way?
I don't want to talk about him because it leads me into minutiae away from the
got
main
it.
Concept,
okay.
right?
Okay.
That's just one way to see it.
Okay.
He's looking at a little part of that particular elephant, right?
Okay.
But it's dollar domination. It's the residual status of the dollar is the world reserve currency used for all international lending, raw materials, oil, you name it, it's the dollar. Now, the problem is this domination of the dollar is absurd, obsolete, it's ending. We've had just in the past week, Syria has decided to dump the dollar. Iraq had dumped the dollar. They've been forced back to the dollar by military invasion. North Korea dumped the dollar.
You have to play our game.
The U.S. occupation put them back on the dollar. They don't want to be. It's just a question of time until Russia and European Union dump the dollar for energy transactions and go to the euro. Venezuela is in the process of dumping the dollar, and so on down the line. The question is, the emergence of
and when you dump the dollar, you dump Anglo-American control.
Yes, you cut them out of, you
then
deprive
it,
them.
Then it becomes euro is German and French and...
It's better. It's better in the sense that it's better to have two rival systems where you can play one against the other than to have one system.
Laissez-faire, right?
No, the opposite.
I would say.
I'm not interested in laissez-faire.
No?
Let me finish. Let me try to round out the concept. Maybe it'll become clearer.
Okay.
As long as you have the dollar and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank is the only game in town, then these countries are all crushed. This was the reality of the 1990s. Now, even if you had the dollar on the one side and the euro on the other, you could say, well, the European Central Bank, that's as ugly an oligarchy as you'll ever find. Sure, it is. But at least there'd be two. You'd have a situation a little bit more like the Cold War, where if you were a third world country, you'd try to get something from Washington. If you didn't get it, you could go to Moscow.
Right.
And somehow
right.
out of that, you could eke out a little bit better deal than you got if there was only one and you had to take whatever you were given.
Right.
This, I think, would be a step forward.
Right.
Now, the people in London and New York, as I say, are hysterically committed to maintaining this dollar hegemony and their world domination. And if you look at the September 11th events, if you ask for the why, the ultimate why of this is to maintain U.S.-British world domination, to be able to suppress and crush attempts to challenge the dollar. He said, but look at Chavez of Venezuela. He tries to use other currencies. He'll even do barter deals. But if you're Cuba, you don't have any money, he'll say, send me some doctors.
Cigars. Or
no, doctors, medical doctors. Personnel. The Venezuelan countryside now has the best medical treatment they've ever had. Because,
from Cuba?
Yeah, from Cuba. Because Chavez sends oil to Cuba. Cuba sends back medical doctors. And this is a tremendous plus. Now, the Anglo-Americans don't like that. Because that transaction doesn't go through Wall Street.
Right.
They can't skim 10% off the top.
Right.
And they don't like the idea that people can simply ignore them because then they can't interfere. They want to have their finger in every transaction in the world for money reasons and for reasons of political control. Now, just to bring it up to date, right now, on the 20th of March, we're going to have an epoch-making change in all this. For the first time since the Second World War, there's going to be a market in Iran. It's called the Iranian Oil Bourse, where anybody in the world can go and buy and sell oil, paying in euros, not in dollars. Now, that is the beginning of the end of dollar domination, because it's one thing for a country to say, we Venezuela, or we Iraq, or we Syria will buy and sell all exports in euros. That's one thing. But then to take it a step further and to have an international market where anybody can come and buy and sell these commodities using euros outside of the control of London and New York, that is a world historical strategic event. And that's, of course, what the U.S. and the British have been trying to avoid. And you can see how out of September 11th, we get the Afghan War as a means of blocking the unity of Eurasia, which is definitely on the agenda. You get the Iraq War.
It's not about getting their oil.
Yeah, it's about oil as part of it.
Bit.
But
it's
I wouldn't fetishize oil as the
I
main
see.
Thing.
Because yes.
It's not. It's about world domination, which naturally implies oil. But mainly it implies dollar domination. And once you have dollar domination, then you've got oil, but you've also got every other strategic raw material you can think of, right? All
right.
Available only if you have dollars. And that is exactly what's changing. So the goal of all this, and this is what Samuel Huntington wrote about, right? The main theoretician of the U.S. oligarchy today is Samuel Huntington. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Well, Samuel Huntington is this famous professor, and he's written a book called The Clash of Civilizations. And the big question was, when the Cold War came to an end and the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact collapsed, what would the world look like? And in the early 1990s, he began saying, well, it's going to be a clash of civilizations. It's going to be the West against the Muslims. And he identified, he said, essentially, who is available to challenge U.S.-British world domination? And he said, well, it's going to be the Muslims, the Islamic world, because of their birth rate. They have demographic dynamism. Right? Mm-hmm. They have the highest birth rate in the world. Who else? The Chinese, because of their economic growth rate. They have the greatest economic growth in the world. And then Wolfowitz, from the Bush administration, mm-hmm. right, that I guess you're familiar with.
Yeah, I see.
Wolfowitz added in this notion that you never have to forget about Russia because they're the ones who can destroy you. So it's essentially something like that.
China couldn't?
No, not with the current level of nuclear development.
Capability.
They'd have a harder time.
I see.
So it's essentially an endless war, and this is what the neocons believe in. They say we're going to have war against the Arabs and the Islamic states. That's first. We're going to have China, and we're going to have Russia. And if you think back, before 9/11, if you look at the neocons, what they were doing, the neocons are sort of the loudmouth, abrasive public representatives of this invisible government thinking. Right? They exist in a kind of uneasy alliance. The neocons were mainly interested in China. They were trying to get confrontations going with China in the late 90s. And if you think back...
Confrontations, China and who?
The United States.
Oh.
Thermonuclear confrontations.
Oh.
If you look back,
serious stuff.
Let's look back to the early months of the Bush presidency. Remember there was this U.S. spy plane?
The old Bush or the...
The current Bush.
The current Bush.
The tenant in the White House.
Okay.
Remember that there was this U.S. spy plane flying along the coast of China.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese sent up a fighter plane. They collided. Mm-hmm. Remember this?
Yeah.
In the spring of 2001?
Right. Yeah.
At that point, if you watched the neocons, as I tried to do, The neocons were saying, this is the confrontation we wanted. We've been waiting all through Clinton for a president who would give us confrontation. What they wanted to do was to go to the brink of thermonuclear war, force China to back down, and use that then to begin to break up China and eliminate what they considered to be a very dangerous competitor right. for world domination. And the problem was, Bush did nothing. He sat in the White House. He did his running. You know, he has to sleep 10 hours a day, exercise 3 hours a day. His work day, I'm sorry, Clinton's work day is longer than Bush's work week. So Bush did nothing. And that this, I think this is an important moment in the gestation of 9/11, that everybody could see that if you waited for Bush to give you a confrontation, you'd never get it. He would be just as bad as Clinton from their point of view. Clinton didn't want military
action.
Clinton
was in Serbia. He liked military action.
Complicated story, because by the time the Serbian bombing took place, Clinton was not really president anymore. In other words, he'd mortgaged himself so heavily to avoid conviction that it was really, I wouldn't blame Clinton exclusively. I would blame the bombing of Serbia on Gore, Albright, Cohen, Richard Clark.
I see.
What was called the Principals Committee. If you lived here in Washington and you read the paper every day, just the Washington Post, you could see that by the spring of 1999, after Clinton had gotten off, he had essentially mortgaged everything to avoid being thrown out of office.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Principals Committee was running the government, not Clinton. Clinton
so
was
in other
essentially
words,
a,
when
a
Bush,
kind of a
Bush came
relic.
In, so when Bush came in, it was not a happy day for people who liked confrontation.
They had been praying for Bush all during the 1990s, saying, we've got to somehow, they see China getting stronger every year, U.S. getting weaker every year, and it's true.
The balance of trade.
The balance of power, trade, yeah. power, you name it. You can take any data series you want, and you'll see the Chinese are growing, the U.S. is stagnating at best. So they're saying, we've got to have a confrontation to get out of this. We've got to smash them up before we're too weak to do it. Now we've got Bush. And then we have this incident with the U.S. plane in the hands of the Chinese. And the obvious thing was to say, we want the plane back, to try to make a series of unrealistic demands on the Chinese, get to a confrontation, force them to back down because their nuclear forces are not going to be enough, and then have the Chinese government lose face and begin to break up China. That was what they wanted. And Bush, out of that, gave them zero, goose egg.
Mm-hmm.
Weak, passive president who sits in the Oval Office and waits for somebody to tell him what to do. I think that's the moment when 9/11 became the immediate perspective, because they say in order to move this regime, the Bush presidency and the U.S. government, it takes a powerful outside event. In other words, it will never come from a president.
You know, I don't like to say or think nasty things. I have a spiritual, benevolent type of background, and yet from a purely military point of view, if you're looking on the world as one filled with enemies, striking China would not be such a dumb idea.
It's
totally against all my...
Good,
I'm just
and
trying
should
to,
stay that way.
I'm just trying to say with you, are neocons madmen, or are they
madmen.
Or are they military strategists?
No, they're not military strategists.
Why? Tell me why.
They have to be, in my terminology, the proper epithet is neocon fascist madmen. They're not conservatives in any sense. There's nothing
they're
they
radical.
Want to conserve.
They're radical.
They're
extreme.
Fascists. They don't believe in tradition. They don't like tradition, custom, precedent.
Let's take a look
Wait.
At... Okay.
They don't like tradition, custom, precedent, the status quo. They have contempt for the Constitution.
About
they have
religion.
Contempt.
What about the fundamentalist religion?
If you read what they write, they say these are the lies we tell for the stinking masses to
really?
Keep them gulled.
Where can we...
Strauss, all in the book.
Leo Strauss.
That's their guru, this guy right here.
And he says, okay.
He says
we'll do this a little later because
we'll
I'd like to show
we'll
this picture. Okay.
So the neocons, they have one answer to everything. Military confrontation, invasion, war. Neocons are one-trick ponies. Other people might say, well, you might negotiate, or you could have economic competition. No, not the neocons. With the neocons, everything has to be resolved by bloody, violent war, confrontation, either force or at least the threat of force.
This I'm is right, the only you're wrong, world. And I beat you, right?
This is, and they're profoundly racists. That's the other thing. They say, well, what races are going to challenge us? The Muslims, the Islamic world. Naturally, the neocons are also, they have a thoroughgoing obsession with the security needs of Israel. This is clear enough.
Why is this?
Because for many of them, it's a matter of personal contact, but it's also a cynical use of Israel as a gambit or a pawn in a geopolitical game that the Israelis can only lose. I would just point out, I mentioned Samuel Huntington. In that book, The Clash of Civilizations, he writes about the Third World War, all right? The Third World War is Japan, China, the Arab and Islamic world against U.S., Europe, India, Russia. In the course of this war, Israel is destroyed. It is literally wiped off the face of the earth.
Why?
Because this is how he thinks it's going to happen. And indeed...
Why can't Israel line up with the U.S.?
They do, but they're destroyed anyway.
Oh, because we destroyed our World Trade Center,
because
so we don't mind...
They are destroyed because it's the Third World War, and this is a tiny country surrounded by Arab and Islamic states.
You mean in military planning and war games?
I'm trying to argue that the only rational course for Israel would be a peace deal as soon as possible to try to neutralize and mitigate the hostility of its neighbors, entering into productive and fruitful economic relationships with all the surrounding states. That would be a reasonable perspective for Israel. Anybody who tells Israel, you'll find your salvation in war, is a madman.
Uh-huh.
And we've had plenty of these madmen. And I would say to any Israeli, your hope is peace. You've got to find ways to make peace, and you've got to find ways to overcome the hostilities of the past and to get to a...
But they're not allowed to. They're goosed on by us constantly.
Yes,
right?
And I think that's what the neocons are. In other words, the neocons are people who are there to make sure that none of that ever happens, because somehow the authority of the neocons inside the United States depends on their relations with Israel. But those are only useful for them if there's total confrontation and any kind of negotiated peace. I mean, you have to think, the neocons saw during the 1990s the Oslo Accords of the Palestinians with Israel, and they also saw the Good Friday Accords of the British with Northern Ireland. And for the neocons, you have to remember the premise...
Nightmare. Peace.
It's the end of the world. Because, and Huntington says it,
uh-huh.
He says, if you want to have a society of this type, meaning an oligarchical one,
mm-hmm.
you have to have what he calls an enemy image. You must have a foreign enemy. Mm-hmm. Now, as long as you had the Soviets, you had a real one and a quite formidable one. But once the Soviets are no longer the obvious enemy, what do you do? And that's Huntington's implicit answer as well. If you don't have one, you better manufacture one. And that's 9/11. 9/11... with these wild charges, right? You see these planes crashing, you see the buildings falling down for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the government, Bush comes out and says, Al-Qaeda bin Laden, Al-Qaeda bin Laden. There's no proof.
Mm-hmm.
But what that has done is to create this illusion, this fantastic myth that somehow the Arab and Islamic world is a nest of terrorists and that they're coming to destroy the United States. Now, this is another point that I have to make, so let me just indulge me a little bit. This myth right
indulge
now...
Indulge away.
Okay. This
explain
myth...
right into... Yeah, it's usually... Oh, you're
this
on.
This myth is now the key to U.S. politics. Karl Rove, in 2002, in January, and Karl Rove again now in 2006, at the same meeting of the Republican National Committee, made clear... The basis of the Bush Republican campaign is September 11th as this fantastic, scary myth, Atta, bin Laden, terrorism, and so forth, right? Remember, Rove's point of view was the Democratic Party is pre-9/11 in its mentality, and the Republican Party has entered
right.
into the full understanding
right.
of the real terrorist threat. Now... There are a lot of people in the world who are left liberals or radical liberals, and I imagine a lot of them are watching this program. If you're against Bush and you're against Iraq, I can sympathize with you very deeply because I'm against these things too. But what I have to point out to you is that if this is the limit of your agitation and your propaganda, you will fail. You must address the myth of September 11th. It is a fantastic myth. The people who are accused, the 19... allegedly from Saudi Arabia, Atta, and the rest of them, There's no proof that links them to anything. And indeed, many of them seem to be either alive or double agents of the U.S. government. We could talk about that. The Twin Towers, as we discussed before, came down through controlled demolition. What hit the Pentagon is every indication a cruise missile or something of this type. The Shanksville aircraft was apparently shot down by the U.S. government. It's an inside job. In other words, it is the handiwork of this rogue network inside the U.S. institutions. If you don't face this issue, you are lost. You can't do anything about Bush. You can't do anything about the Iraq War without facing this. The reason for this is simple. This myth of terrorism, the fantastic official story of 9/11, is compelling to 35% to 40% of the U.S. population. You can see Bush's approval rating. When he's down, he gets close to 35%, and then he bumps up to 40% or maybe a little bit more. It's about 35% to 40% of this population that are so terrified, their mental equipment is so limited. I mean, a lot of them are cretins, and we have to face this fact that there's a very large cretinous.
What does cretin mean?
They're very dumb people. They're people of very limited mental equipment. Right? Maybe I'm using it as a polemical term. But they're terrified, they're confused, and if you have an argument with them, if you say, we don't like the war in Afghanistan, we don't like the war in Iraq, they'll say, well, that has to be because of 9/11. We don't like NSA wiretapping. It has to be because of 9/11. We don't like secret prisons, torture, Abu Ghraib, renditions, black sites. We need all of those, the average person will say, of this 35% to 40% because of 9/11. If you don't crack this nut, you cannot get anywhere. You cannot attrit or erode Bush's base of support to the point where you'd be able to put an end to the war. As long as Bush can retain a 35% to 40% base of support, he will wage war indefinitely, and he will continue to implement police state dictatorial measures on the home front. Think, if you will, about what this position, and it's common to the left gatekeepers. Can we mention a few left gatekeepers?
Yes.
Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, Noam Chomsky, probably the most famous, Michael Moore.
Greg Palast,
another good one. Molly Ivins, Noam Chomsky, I guess I've said. I wish I had my list of left gatekeepers, but I guess you think the idea. These are radical liberals, left liberals, who are very much against Bush, very much against the Iraq War, but they're not able, morally and intellectually so far, to pull themselves together to attack the Kaine-Hamilton Commission version of these events. Now, what does it mean? They are willing to listen to Bush on this issue.
We have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Yeah. All right, let me just try to wrap up then. If you go to these people and you say, do you believe Bush about the budget? They'd say no. Do you believe Bush about wiretapping? No. Do you believe Bush about 9/11? Well, the answer seems to be yes, because they embrace the official version. They talk about the 19 hijackers, the Saudi Arabians, bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Atta, and the rest of all this. These are people who would be mortified. They would die of shame if they found that they were listening to Bush on any issue like prescription drugs or, you know, important things, but
ecology,
nevertheless not
right, the environment,
anything. But in this case, they're willing to embrace Bush's point of view. Their position also adds up to saying Bush was a liar before 9/11. After 9/11, he told the truth for a while, and now he's lying again because of Iraq and now Iran. So I have to appeal to people. If you want to put an end to these endless wars, and if you want to do something about the Bush administration, you've got to attrit and erode that base. And the only way to do it is to dismantle, deconstruct, take down the myth of 9/11 and attack it in its details. Because otherwise, if you have the Democratic Party argument saying, well, we all agree that. Well, no, we don't agree. We damn well better not agree. Because once you've agreed that, then you're lost. And then you've lost the entire argument, because as soon as you agree that there was 9/11 and therefore you have to have the war on terror, Bush wins. He'll always be able to demagogue the issue better than anybody else.
Well, very well said. Webster, thank you so much for joining us here. This is Paul.